This is the Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.starktruthradio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Zoltan Istvan. He's a candidate for president under the Republican Party nomination, and he's previously ran as a transhumanist candidate for president and a candidate for California governor, and he's author of The Transhumanist Wager and has a recent book on political essays. Zoltan, it's great talking to you.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So you're running as a new type of Republican, and why the Republican Party instead of the Transhumanist Party, and what are your thoughts on the direction of the GOP in regards to becoming more culturally open-minded and technologically innovative?
Well, you know, first off, you know, when I founded the Transhumanist Party, it's just a very small political party about science and technology. It doesn't really have any infrastructure to run national campaigns and or especially to get elected. So, you know, going to the GOP has a lot to do with just practicalities. I want to be able to get on ballots. I want to be able to get, you know, tap into the infrastructure that's out there. So the Republican Party really offers a lot of that when running a presidential campaign. And ultimately, though, you know, I'm hoping that by being a new type of Republican, I might get a whole bunch of younger GOP voters, and also maybe even some Democrats that are in the middle or libertarians. So when I talk about being a new type of Republican, it's really just one who's interested in science and technology and also more socially open. I don't fight all the social battles that a lot of the older conservatives fight.
Do you believe that science and technology can fix most of the nation's and world's problems?
I absolutely do. In fact, I think really that's the best method to do it. The scientific method is the very best method to fix problems, because we use pure logic, we use statistics, we use analysis, and we try to do the greater good, greatest good for the greatest amount of people from a very logical perspective. If you use religion, or if you use your, you know, ethnic background, or if you use your heritage, or if you use historical precedents, these things are all biased, but science is not biased, and so I think it's the best way to go.
Can you give a brief introduction to the concept of transhumanism, and what are some examples of specific policies you'd like to see implemented, such as radical life extension? What's the role of the state?
Yeah, absolutely. So transhumanism is a social movement of now many millions of people around the world that want to use science and technology to upgrade the human being and also to upgrade the human experience, whatever it is. It can be anything from brain implants that let you, you know, tie your brain thoughts directly to a machine interface. It could be exoskeleton suits that let, you know, the disabled walk up Mount Everest. It could be also be simpler things like driverless cars, but it's always radical technology. And of course, the state using it can be good in terms of reducing the size of the state and making it more transparent, and also just making it a bit more functional. And I think the people can use it for exactly the same reasons in terms of voting and safety, and in terms of, you know, I think just overall functionality and essentially having a better, more prosperous life. Technology has, from a historical perspective, has always helped us kind of ascend this ladder of evolving, and we're getting better at it because of science and technology.
You advocate using AI to recognize trauma. What are your thoughts on the privacy issues in regards to surveillance? So Say someone was to commit a crime in their own home, and would AI notify law enforcement, like the issues of privacy?
Well, so that's a very challenging one in your own home. I'm not sure we need to be peering into people's own homes. But when I talk about anything on the street, or you talk about a plaza or a public space or maybe a football stadium, hey, I think AI is going to be very, very useful in terms of safety, primarily just helping somebody. You know, you have, for example, an older person that has a heart attack and no one's paying attention and he just peels over. Well, AI that could be monitoring, let's say a football stadium, could say, hey, and then send some emergency people out to that person, maybe save that person's life. That, of course, that person's probably a father and somebody loves him. Or it could be something more in terms of a child getting abducted, and AI is able to really quickly say, wait a sec, that doesn't look right, that this child was once with, you know, 5 seconds ago with her mother, and now she's being ripped away in a car. These are times when AI could immediately recognize the issue and notify authorities. So in public spaces, I think AI is going to be really great for safety, but I do think that it's going to be, you know, very challenging. I'm not advocating for anything in anyone's home yet. I think that's a bridge too far for me, even. And I'm usually known for being quite you know, far-fetched when it comes to a lot of this AI and privacy issues.
You're advocating a basic income, and can you give some information on the statistics, how you generate the revenue, your estimate of the exact amount that basic income would be, and also the issues in regards to it be from a federal and dividend, and also address some of the environmental concerns?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when everyone hears basic income, they think, oh, this is a socialist policy or a far left policy. However, there are various types of basic incomes that actually can come from the right or are more libertarian minded, as mine is. And I have a basic income that's entirely tax free. So, you know, 50% of the Western United States, 11 most Western United States states in the U.S. are essentially empty federal land. So there are tons of resources, like Nevada, for example, is like 96% just empty. It has a ton of mineral resources, about the same amount of mineral resources as Afghanistan. So we're talking trillions of dollars. We can monetize those resources and then pay a basic income out to every single American that is living. And that amount of money could be anywhere from $1,000 to upwards of even $1,700. There's approximately $150 to $200 trillion worth of natural resources in America. And I think it's time that we take those natural resources and try to end poverty. If people can't afford insurance, perhaps we could get them insurance through that, or perhaps we could use it for educational reform, or perhaps we could even use it to pay for the military so people don't have to pay taxes for the military. But whatever it is, America's holding on to an amazing amount of natural resources. And what I call this is a federal land dividend. We monetize these resources, we lease it out to big business, and then we pay people or pay some type of service for the country. I think it's best just give people a check. Now, the biggest issue with this, everybody sort of thinks, oh, this is great. It's really free money. We don't need to raise taxes to get it. But the big problem is that it's going to require us to, you know, destroy the environment. I mean, if you talk about, for example, some of the forestry in Oregon, you know, in the federal lands that are out there, you would be clear cutting forests. However, we would hopefully regrow them. But if you're talking about, you know, mineral and stuff like that in Nevada, well, you know, you would be talking about destroying land. So there are some environmental concerns. However, my plan in no way would touch any national parks. So my plan does not include any national parks. So we would be touching mostly land that people really never, ever see. And you have to remember that poverty is such a major issue in America. For example, California has 13 million people living right at the poverty line. So a lot of these people can't even afford to see nature. What they really need is food. I mean, sometimes some statistics say one out of every five children in America has malnutrition or is even hungry, starving. So I think it's we owe it to the American people to start monetizing this vast amount of federal land and trying to get money into their pockets so that they can afford housing and things like that. And that would help the economy out dramatically. Of course, it's a bipartisan idea. The Republicans love it because it helps big business. The Democrats love it because it takes care of poverty.
What is your immigration policy, and should immigration levels take into account that a lot of the jobs in the future will be automated?
Yeah, so, you know, I have a very challenging immigration policy. I have probably the most liberal, and this is a little bit ironic running as a Republican. I have essentially a very libertarian, you know, view of immigration. I think it should be essentially open borders. And however, I think immigrants that do come into the country should be doing two things. First off, for 3 years, they should be tracked. I mean, we can't just let in anyone in the country without at some point monitoring them and seeing what they're doing and making sure that they're actually working and not utilizing government resources. Two, I think every single immigrant should leave a security deposit of some sort for those 3 years while they're here before they earn their citizenship. And right now I'm saying that would be a $5,000 refundable security deposit. If we were to do that and these immigrants were to use any government services, whether it's criminality or whether it's just health services for children, it would come out of that money. So America isn't paying the tab for it. However, I very much favor immigrants coming. I think one of the biggest challenges America faces is competing against China, which has four times our population. So this idea that we want to kind of keep America small and not let any immigrants in order to compete with China in the near future, we're going to need more people. We're going to need to create more jobs. Hopefully we'd create brand new cities. So the issue, though, is what happens in the 10 or 20 or 30 year future when we have automation? Well, I think that's a very different question because, you know, I'm running for presidency right now. And while automation is a very large issue, and there's no question 30, 40, 50 years down the road, probably 80, 90% of jobs will be wiped out. You know, right now there's job growth still occurring. And even though robots are certainly going to on the horizon, they're coming, they might start driving trucks and whatnot soon. At this moment in the economy, that's not an immediate concern. It might be by, let's say, the election of 2028. It'll probably be a major concern then.
You advocate licensing parents. Can you explain the process of how that would work? I guess there would probably be some concern about civil liberties with that. And I know it's a taboo issue, but do you believe that there's genetic characteristics that position one towards poverty or crime?
Look, I'll answer your, you know, the more controversial question. I don't think that there's any kind of genetic disposition that makes anyone either stronger or better or worse or more successful. That said, I mean, there are some physical differences. I mean, there's no way that I could be competitive in marathon races compared to, let's say, a Kenyan or something like that. But, you know, and probably the same thing of basketball. I don't think my genes necessarily are really good for that. However, at the same time, I just think ultimately, you know, and I've said this and this gets me in trouble all the time, but there's no such thing as equality. Our DNA is 100% different than, well, not 100%, but it's completely different than somebody else's. So this is not in any way to, you know, tackle racism or bigotry or anything like that. It's just to stop being so politically correct and say, wait a sec, there are differences between people. However, there's been so many classic stories of somebody who might have been a minority who has worked really hard and then created billions and billions. And so every single person, I believe, can reach the American dream. But the idea of us all being born equal is completely not true. And there are big differences as well between the sexes. And in the future with the transhumanism technology, there's going to be big differences between people that are changing their sexes all the time. So, you know, and then we have the cyborgs and people adding different things to their brains, implants and genetic editing and stuff like that. So it gets very crazy really quickly. But one thing I know for sure is transhumanism is the least discriminatory movement that I have ever discovered, because we believe in almost becoming a different species in itself. So I think, you know, when you talk about transhumanists, we are so open-minded. I mean, half my friends want to become a fish and grow gills so they can breathe underwater and do things like that. So we're way beyond colors, we're in skin, you know, color of skin. We're way beyond different types of ethnicities and stuff like that. I mean, I'm much closer to when can I take off my arm and put on a robotic arm? And hey, I'm going to be honest with you, in 10, 20 years, a robotic arm is going to be way better than any human arm. It doesn't really matter what color you are or what your genetic makeup is or any of those things. So, you know, I'm a big believer in the future, but it's not a future of discrimination or even where we worry about some of the civil liberties of the past. It's much more about where are we going in the future and how can we upgrade ourselves so we can become the strongest physical beings that we can be.
And also, can you explain the licensing program for parents?
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry. So, you know, this is the most tricky subject. And I got to be honest, I wonder now, it might have been better to keep this uncovered during my campaign, because while I believe very strongly in licensing children, it is just getting me in endless amounts of trouble. But let me just tell you the basis of it. There are approximately 10 to 15 million kids right now in America that are going to bed. It's nighttime here in California, and they're malnourished, and they're hungry, and maybe they're being abused. There's 2 to 3 million of domestic violence cases every year, and most of them are children. There's a lot of children that don't have a very good upbringing, and there's a lot of parents that don't have money. They don't even have necessarily the sensibility to raise a child because of whatever circumstances has happened in their lives. So I have proposed this idea that, and I don't like using the government for it. Maybe it could be nonprofits. Maybe it could be an international organization of some sort. But there would be this idea that we would license parents. And it's a very simple thing, something like going to the DMV and getting a driver's license, maybe a 15-minute process. Look, if you're not homeless and you have a job and you have a place to live and bring up your child, and you can put that child in school, and you can make sure that that child doesn't like choke in its bed, and you can feed it and make sure it's healthy and things like that, then you get a green light to have a child. And here's the license. And there would be financial, and under, if I was president, there would be financial incentives to have those children, and the government would give you financial benefits for having that. Now, I'm not going to make it criminal that if you don't get the license, you go to jail, something like that. It's nothing like that. But you would miss out on various financial benefits because you chose not to get a license for your children. Now, let's be honest. There's about 10% of the parents out there probably shouldn't be parents. You don't want someone who's, you know, shooting up heroin to be raising kids. But that is happening sometimes. You don't want child molesters to be raising kids. You don't want violent felons to be raising kids. And you don't want the homeless to be raising kids. There are people out there that probably the government should stand up and say, wait a sec. Let us think before we do this. And from my perspective, kind of the libertarian perspective, I'm paying so much in taxes just for these people's benefit so that they can have three, or some type of inner city people have three, four, or five children that live entirely off the government. This is not what the taxes that I want to pay. I want to pay taxes for real things, for roads and bridges and things like that, and science. So I think licensing parents would, first off, reduce taxes for the broad majority of Americans. And also, most importantly, it would save those American children, those 10 to 15 million of them, who are suffering because they don't have good parents. Now, a licensing program would be something where parents, if they're good, get it. And if they're not, the government would work with parents, maybe through educational programs or through some type of, you know, different type of service, where it gives them a job and makes sure that they become adequately prepared to raise children. Now, I got two children. I got a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old. This is a 24-hour, 7 days a week type of job. And in order to make sure that they're going to end up strong and end up good Americans that contribute to the overall system and the benefit of the country, we need to work very hard. And what's happening is we have an enormous amount of people that don't have good childhoods, and then they join gangs, they join inner city, you know, slums. They never leave it. So I think it'd be better to hold off, to make licensing a national priority, and to make sure that parents are always prepared. And again, I'm not saying that you're never going to be able to have a child. It's not like that at all. We would work with people so that they would become good citizens and able to be prepared to have a child. I'm in no way just saying it's not, you're going to shut down people. But, you know, some people are not ready to take on this enormous responsibility of parenting, and the government might need to work with them to get them to a suitable place. And that's where this kind of licensing program comes in. As controversial as it sounds, you have to understand that there are 7,000 to 8,000 kids that die from starvation every day around the world. I wish the entire world had a licensing program. Not only is it good for the environment, but it's good for those children. We have lost 30 or 40 million children over the last 30 or 40 years from starvation because of bad parents that probably shouldn't have gotten pregnant.
Can you talk about your proposal to automate bureaucracy, downsize the government using technology?
Well, absolutely. There's an enormous amount of new technologies coming through the pipeline right now. Blockchain probably being the biggest one, where we're able to do things like marriage certificates, or you're able to do things like real estate transactions, or just even different types of Bitcoin and different types of cryptocurrencies. There's methods. Include, and, you know, if you really want to get spacey, there's even the idea that certain types of government jobs. You know, when you walk into the DMV, it can be entirely automated away. And there's even some people that say at some point, politicians might be automated away, as we'll use algorithms to kind of determine how best to move the country forward. But the point, though, is that technology streamlines basically everything. And the more we can streamline the government, the smaller we can make it. And the smaller we make the government, the less taxes we have to pay. And I'm a believer, especially since we own so much federal land, that at some point we're going to have robots that are able to produce more robots through the natural resources we have in America. And we could get to a point when the government is almost nothing. There's almost no taxes to be paid, if any at all. And still, as a nation, we can run ourselves very successfully. That would be a great goal of mine. No taxes and complete automation running this thing we call the government, which I'm no fan of. I would much rather have a much smaller government.
How can we use technology to greater protect humankind from existential risks?
Well, so, you know, ultimately you have a couple different types of things out there. So, for example, you know, right now we're dealing with this new virus, the coronavirus. This is a, you know, a somewhat of a sketchy thing because we're literally 4 or 5 days into it. And every single day it seems like there's something new. Now there's 3 or 4 cities of 10 million each on complete lockdown in China. So AI might have been able to spot some of these things if it had been put out in the public or done things like this where you could say, wait a second, that person looks sick or that person looks sick. You know, it's possible that this virus expands and all of a sudden we have millions of people dying like happened in the 1918 flu epidemic. However, that's one way technology could work. Another way is just all, you know, right now we've been having astronomers looking into the skies for asteroids to hit planet Earth. People think it's such a, like, you know, science fiction movie that an asteroid hits the planet without realizing that over the last billion years, I mean, there have been hundreds of thousands of asteroids that have hit the planet, some that would cause tens of millions of lives to be lost, and perhaps even climate change. I mean, real climate change on a global level. So we could have AI consistently searching out there. And then there's things like genetic editing. You know, we have the problem with, let's say, if it's a mental disease or it's a disability. Well, genetic editing can help a lot of these different things, especially at the embryonic stage when we get to designer babies, where you can kind of weed out someone's tendency to have cancer. So instead of a child watching his mother die from cancer, that mother doesn't have to ever get cancer again because she was born with a genetic trait that says she doesn't get cancer. These are all the different ways that tech, I mean, of course, you know, there are thousands of ways that technology can help humanity. And it's not just helping humanity. It's just getting countries to run more smoothly and just in a way where people don't have to suffer all the time. You know, the great goal of transhumanism is really to eliminate suffering. I know that sounds sort of metaphysical, but we want to end suffering outright. We want to make it so that people don't have to go through painful experiences unless they want to. And that's really it, whether it's modifying our body or whether it's modifying our brain and mind through different types of technologies, it's always the same. We're looking to eliminate suffering and make people live longer and better.
How can technology be used to protect the environment? And do you generally favor more state intervention or free market solutions to the environment?
I 100% support the free market solutions right now. Look, and this is where we get into this idea of post-earther that I've written an article about. Post-earther is this idea that in itself, nature is somewhat antagonistic. Nature is somewhat, I don't want to say immoral, but I mean, you step outside into the wilderness, and let me tell you, it's a dog-eat-dog world. I mean, everything's trying to eat one another. I feel it's humans' responsibility as the most evolved entity on planet Earth to really try to bring morality and some type of semblance of reason to planet Earth. Now, that's very metaphysical, but, you know, just getting down to the nuts and bolts, what it means is progress has made it where, yes, it's true, we've probably changed the climate, and yes, we've destroyed portions of the Earth, but give it progress another 30 or 40 or 50 years, and we're going to have nanotechnologies, we're going to have artificial intelligence, we're going to have genetic, I mean, we can already grow plants twice as quickly. And very soon we're going to enter the nanotechnology age where we can recreate all sorts of forests, all sorts of land masses just through our own ingenuity. And talk about wildlife. You know, I worked as a director at a major wildlife organization for a while. It used to be that you have to protect animals and endangered wildlife from poaching. Now the very best method is Jurassic Park style. Grow the endangered wildlife in a petri dish and release it into the wild, and that's how you replenish population. So it's through technology, and this sounds so contradictory to what you would think. Most people think, oh, to save the planet, we need to lessen our carbon footprint. But the truth is, we actually have to speed up progress to the point when we get to kind of the golden age of transhumanism, where we have the ability to recreate matter as we want, and then we can recreate the planet in this beautiful, you know, pristine landscape with all the animals that once were here and all these other things that we have sort of destroyed. And of course, through geoengineering, where you control climates, we're getting good at that. We're starting to take sand and create, you know, greenify, you know, basically make these giant, beautiful, lush, like kind of paradises out of just sand. I mean, there's all these new technologies coming, including being able to use geoengineering to, you know, to essentially make temperatures drop or make temperatures rise so that we can control climate. The further we get along progress, the better chance we're going to have of returning the Earth to what it once was, or to a point that's very pristine for human beings. So I believe very strongly that it's actually progress and the radical green transhumanist technologies that will save the planet. Reducing the carbon footprint, especially with India and its 1.5 billion, soon 1.5 billion people, and China, which is 1.2 or 3 billion people. There's no stopping these people from developing. What's going to save planet Earth, though, is our ingenuity. We're going to come up with innovations to make it beautiful and pristine again.
What should the state's role in technological innovation be?
As small as possible. Basically, if people are being hurt, it should be the state's role to step in and regulate at that point. But if people are not being hurt, not directly being hurt especially, then I think the state's role is just to have a hands-off attitude. I have a very libertarian attitude when it comes to medicine, when it comes to you know, what the state should do. With the exception, I want to make this very clear, with the exception of children, and this kind of goes back to the licensing parents and stuff. When it comes to kids, maybe up to age, you know, I know some people say the legal age is 18, but I would say it's, you know, when kids become adults, it's probably closer to 23 or 24. I think at that point, the state has a real incentive to make sure that they follow a certain kind of curriculum, that kids grow up in a good environment, and we shouldn't let some radical out in the middle of the desert decide how to raise his 10 kids. I think then the state is okay. But as soon as these kids become an adult, 100% hands off. Leave these people to be and let them do what they want to do. We can trust adults to do what they want to do. And if they commit crimes, we can put them in jail. But generally, most of them, 95% of them, are good people and innovative people. So this is a really strange idea I have, and libertarians have criticized me for it because they haven't really figured out exactly. It's not libertarian paternalism. It's something different. It's this idea that kids are better taken care of by a collective consciousness of the people. But as adults, that's best left entirely to its own doing. And I haven't actually even come up with a term for this idea yet, but I've been thinking a lot about it all this year as I've been working on my philosophies and my ideas for this political presidential run. It's just this idea that children are better off by a collective idea of a collective idea of rules. But as soon as you become adults, I think it's then like capitalism, just lazy fare, just let it run free, and then you can trust them. Because as adults, people can screw up, people can mess up, and you know, they have to own their mess ups. That's the world. But when it comes to children, you know, we owe the right to protect them. Their brains are just not mature enough to be protected, and a lot of parents are incapable of doing a good job. But when people are adults, my God, let them at it. Let them do whatever they want to do.
We're getting close to the end of the show. Can you give out the information about your campaign, including your website?
Absolutely. So my political website is Zoltan2020.com. If you're interested in my former journalism, I've written about 230 opinion pieces, some for the New York Times and other places. You can just Google my name, or you can just look at my other website, my personal website, which is ZoltanEastlawn.com. And I do have a new book out. It's called Upgrading America, The Political Writings of Zoltan Eastlawn. It's on Amazon, as well as a few other books I've written recently. So you can just check out all my essays, or you can just Google. There's a lot of stuff out there, fun stuff, wacky stuff, cool stuff. And most of it's about transhumanism, and some of it's about the recent presidential run. And, of course, in case you're interested in voting for me, I'm going to be on a number of major state ballots, including New Hampshire, which is coming up here in about 2 weeks.
Zoltan Istvan, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.